undeniable facilitating effect on the Hutu's extremists.
Experts have proved that French authorities received many alerts during the ongoing genocide. In this video, shot in Rwanda during the genocide, a French sergeant warns the French Army's Chief of Special Operations that Tutsis are being massacred not far from where they are. But the French colonel does not react.
Complicity means help, and France allows the creation of an extremist government and its recognition by the international community. The perpetrators of genocide are welcome in France, and they find shelter in France and in Belgium once the genocide is completed. France delivers weapons before, during, and after the genocide. All this means political complicity.
Rwanda is a small country, mostly agricultural, with very few natural resources. No big deal. So why this was of interest to France?
France gives the support to dictators. If one goes down, the others will not trust France anymore. In the beginning of France-Afrique in the 60s, France abandoned one dictator and the consequences were catastrophic. Mitterrand and other French presidents swore not to abandon any other African dictator.
The report on Paris's role in the Rwandan genocide has other downsides besides trying to obscure France's real role. The probe was carried out with Parliament, where Macron's allies have a majority, refusing to give investigators full access to relevant archives. This new report highlights the responsibility of France in the genocide in Rwanda. However, this National Assembly refused to open all the archives, and French authorities still do not want to admit their complicity in the genocide. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, أو you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
This feeling of I don't know and I need guidance is a very important acknowledgement, awareness that we as individuals need to have, and collectively as a community, and globally as people, we need to come to this conclusion. As long as we think we know on our own, we have figured it out, we know what to do, and we just jump on it and start doing it, as long as we have those feelings, those thoughts, we're not going to be able to make that improvement and move towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, reach prosperity, have a better life here and in the hereafter. We're not going to be able to. We've got to come to the point of learning and realizing that we don't know. I don't know how much I can expound or spend time explaining this. Different examples come to mind, different aspects of this idea come to mind. But let me not take too much time on this. Let's move on. And I'll just make this comment. Let's all try to, when we read these du'as, you know, the essence of du'a is to realize I don't have, whether it's knowledge, guidance, direction, or it's other things. I don't have and He has, and I need it, and I'm asking Him. While we're doing that, but particularly on that idea that I mentioned, that I really don't know, I need your guidance. I am in dire need. If you don't take my hand, If you don't show me how to do this, I'm going to keep screwing up. And the worst part of that is not even realizing that I'm screwing up, thinking that I'm doing okay or I'm doing good even, not realizing that I've wasted 38 years of my life. And where am I? Where could have I or could I have been by now? And where am I right now? I've wasted all of that time. How much time do I have? Do I have 2 more years? Do I have 1 year? Do I have 10 years? Do I have 5 years? Do I have 20 years? And if this keeps going the way it is, where will I end? Where will my ending be? So that's one thing that we should come to initially in order to be able to then receive the guidance from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When I feel like I know, I have, even if I say the words, I read the du'as, I ask Allah, I am not serious in asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm arrogantly asking. I'm asking, just saying the words, but internally I'm feeling like I don't need that. And that's very disrespectful. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows. And we are not capable of receiving with that mentality, with that. Moving on from this, emptying our minds and thoughts, thinking that, oh, really, I don't have and I need. What should we do? What should I do? I don't know how much this is possible, but I'm going to encourage all of us to try to do this. And perhaps it can be a start. That is to change our relationship with the Quran. All these years we've had a certain relationship with the Quran. We have not had a strong bond with the Quran. We have not looked at the Quran as a book that if I have questions, I need to look into the book itself and try to find answers in the Quran and then apply them. I have not looked at the Quran as a book that, as I believe it's Imam Zain al-Abidin salamullah alayh, that has said, according to the account, that if there's no one around me, I don't have anyone with me, the only thing I have is a Quran, I won't feel lonely. We don't feel like that towards the Quran. We don't feel this longing, this desire to pick up the book and read it and try to gain and see the light from it. If we're able to change this, if that thought process in our heads regarding the Quran, the way we view the Quran, the way we see the Quran, if we're able to change it from what it was to where it needs to be, which is looking at every word as guidance for me, looking at every verse as speaking to me, God is speaking to me through these words. When I read them, I am reading God's words to me. God's words of guidance. The guidance that I am searching for. I want to do the month of Ramadan better. I want to have a change. I want to be able to start leaping, start moving more rapidly towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I don't have much time. How do I find this? If I change that mindset, it is guaranteed that is the book of guidance. If we change our thought process regarding it and we start becoming more and more familiar with it, keep reading it, keep reading translations, keep checking translations, cross-referencing, asking for tafsir, thinking about it, keep moving, but keep checking the Quran itself. Look at the dictionaries, pick out the words, try to figure it out. keep doing that. If our approach towards the Quran changes, we will start doing that. We will start doing that. The reason why we're not doing that, we're not spending that time on the Quran, is because we don't think that the guidance is there, or we don't think that we can get it. It's either of those two. Both of those are wrong. It is there, and we can get it. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has told us this in the Quran itself. يَهْدِي بِهِ اللَّهِ مَنِ اتَّبَعَ رِضْوَانَهُ سُبُلَ السَّلَامِ. With the Quran, God will guide subul. We've mentioned this on multiple occasions. We will keep mentioning it. Subul is plural. Sirat is one. All of us need to be on Sirat al-Mustaqim. But the sabil that I have on Sirat al-Mustaqim is different than the sabil you have. Sabil is my particular conditions. So when the verse says, يَهْدِي بِهِ اللَّهِ مَنِ اتَّبَعَ رِضْوَانَهُ سُبُلَ السَّلَامِ, besides the general guidance that is there, and that general guidance even I can get, it speaks specifically to my conditions, to my circumstances, provides guidance to me according to this verse. يَهْدِي بِهِ اللَّهِ مَنِ اتَّبَعَ رِضْوَانَهُ سُبُلَ السَّلَامِ. It will teach, or God through it will teach me سُبُلَ السَّلَامِ, my sabil of peace and security, secure paths that will lead me in the right direction. If I change that approach, I will refer to it. And then when I refer to it, again, once that approach is changed towards the Quran, when I read the Quran, I will take it as the most important, most valuable piece of advice anyone can give me. And therefore, I'm not going to take it lightly. I'm going to apply it. I'm going to make sure I understand where it applies, and make sure I implement it. Make sure I implement it. All these questions that we have about our personal lives, about social, political lives, about family lives, about spousal and parental, and all these different issues that we have, the answers are in the Quran. They are in the Quran. And for someone whose heart is enlightened with the Quran, the words of the Ahlul Bayt will illuminate the path further. The Prophet said, إِنِّي تَارِكُمْ فِيكُمْ الثِّقْلَيْنِ كِتَابَ اللَّهُ وَعِتْرَتِي. Both of them need to be together. If you don't have the light of the Quran, you don't have the light of the Ahlul Bayt either. And if you don't have the light of the Ahlul Bayt, you don't have the light of the Quran either. It works both ways. We've got to change that understanding of ours regarding the Quran.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
Nearly a quarter of a million people have died since the start of the Saudi UAE US invasion of Yemen, because of indiscriminate air strikes, a blockade, and preventable diseases resulting from the destruction of civilian infrastructure and a shortage of medical supplies. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William D. Hartung, writer. This article is published under the heading, In Yemen, 6 years of suffering and death in an ill-fated war. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. On March 26, 2015, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates launched an ill-fated war in Yemen, inaugurating what the United Nations has described as the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, as he is known, the architect of the Saudi war effort, asserted that it would be a short conflict with a swift Saudi victory. The Obama administration, which apparently believed MBS's claim supported the war effort, with tens of billions of dollars in arms sales and logistical support. 6 years later, bin Salman's prediction of a short war seems like a cruel joke, and the continued U.S. role in supporting the Saudi-UAE coalition is unconscionable. Nearly a quarter of a million people have died since the start of the Saudi-UAE-US intervention because of indiscriminate airstrikes, a punishing blockade, and preventable diseases resulting from the destruction of civilian infrastructure and a shortage of medical supplies. As a recent report from CNN has documented, the blockade continues to this day, preventing the import of crucial fuel supplies that have left hospitals struggling to operate and impeded the delivery of essential humanitarian aid. David Beasley, the head of the UN World Food Program, underscored the scope of the crisis. I can't say this enough. Once a famine has arrived, we're too late. Without urgent intervention in Yemen this year, we risk losing a child every 75 seconds, unquote. In his first foreign policy speech, the U.S. president claimed that the United States would cease its support for offensive operations in Yemen and stop relevant arms sales. But much more needs to be done, and soon. For starters, Biden should suspend all U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the end of the blockade, support a durable ceasefire, and engage in an inclusive peace process that brings an end to the war, as called for by more than 80 organizations and individuals in a February letter to the administration. Cutting off logistical and maintenance support for the Saudi armed forces would be a particularly effective way to convince the Saudis to end their role in Yemen's suffering. As Bruce Riddle of Brookings Institution has noted, the Royal Saudi Air Force would be grounded in short order without this kind of assistance from the United States. Discontinuing this support would send a stern message to Riyadh to end its reckless actions, which Representative Ted Leo has said look like war crimes to me. While Trump offered a particularly warm embrace to the Saudi regime and its de facto leader, MBS, the Obama administration bears responsibility as well. Trump blocked congressional efforts to cut off the sale of bombs and other equipment to Saudi Arabia, arguing that American jobs and profits for companies like Raytheon, Boeing, and Lockheed Martin were more important than Yemeni lives. He stuck to this immoral and counterproductive policy even after the brutal murder of Saudi journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. But the Obama administration notified Congress of over $115 billion in potential arms sales to Saudi Arabia during its own terms in office, including combat aircraft, attack helicopters, bombs, and missiles that are now being used in the war in Yemen. Former Obama officials, many of whom are now in the Biden administration, have since expressed regret for their administration's support of the Saudi war effort. Now is their chance to do something about it. United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, has spelled out what needs to be done in the short term to reverse the devastation in Yemen. A nationwide ceasefire, along with the opening of the Sana'a airport and ensuring the unhindered flow of fuel into Yemen, are urgent humanitarian imperatives. As Hassan Al-Tayeb of the Friends Committee on National Legislation has noted, the Biden administration must pressure Saudi Arabia to unilaterally end its blockade on Yemen as a humanitarian act, independently of negotiations between the warring parties. Connecting lifting the blockade to ongoing talks is a recipe for prolonging the suffering of the Yemeni people. The Biden administration should use all the tools at its disposal to press the Saudis to make a comprehensive and conditional lifting of the blockade, even as it pushes Saudi Arabia and the UAE to work toward a durable, inclusive peace accord to end the war. After 6 years of war, Yemen can't wait.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran Today.
Facebook shut down Press TV's page without prior warning. That was on Friday, March the 26th. It wasn't the first time, but this time it's permanent. Facebook gave no explanation for its action and no right of appeal to Iran. The American social media platform did say it had banned Press TV for failure to follow Facebook community standards. But it didn't specify how Iran's professional English news network had violated its rules. Also, the so-called community standards are pretty shady and hard to follow. For a review of both media platforms and how it came to this, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Social media sees no borders and requires no visa. It is a platform for citizens of the world to converse freely and exchange knowledge. But is it? It is, selectively. But those not selected may find themselves bound by the very social cyber platform of no boundaries. In our case, we were bound and thrown out of the ring. No fair competition here. No free flow of alternative information. Sounds hardly democratic. I asked for a comment on how an American institution might act this out of character so easily. Mr. Arbedini is a media expert of position. He made a trip to Press TV studios to pitch in.
Such desperate reaction by a country that's the flag bearer of human rights, or so it likes to say. And how can you even analyze such an action?
Previously, they all claimed that they defend alternative voices in cyberspace, but the United States has shown for at least over the past year that it does not adhere to the basic principles of liberal democracy. So former U.S. President Donald Trump is banned from Facebook, Twitter, and several other social media because the deep state made the decision. You can't expect they would allow other voices to be heard.
Here it is. The community standards we supposedly violated. Facebook says of its standards, "We do not allow hate speech on Facebook because it creates an environment of intimidation and exclusion, and in some cases may promote real-world violence." Right, it does. Which is why homegrown terrorists and crazies should be removed from the platform. Except, Facebook doesn't seem to have a problem with them.
در مورد آزادی بیان هم همینطوره.
The same is true about freedom of expression. In the social networks, you see that they allow Iranians to learn how to make bombs, but they do not make the slightest move that is against the idea of liberal democracy. They simply block the account. They don't allow the photo of General Qasem Soleimani to be published. But there are dozens of pages belonging to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. How can you explain such a contradiction?
Where were the standards when white supremacists and thugs used Facebook to recruit crazies? Recruits that reportedly came to Kenosha with assault rifles after the shooting of unarmed Jacob Blake. There's no sign Facebook has any interest in removing domestic terrorists from its platform henceforth either. American social media platforms waste no time in silencing the voice of Iranian media under the pretext of policy violations, but they serve as the playing field of anti-Muslim hate groups and Iranophobes in the name of freedom of expression. Guess hate speech is free if it leads to spilling the right blood. The double standard is jaw-dropping. Mr. Mormenihar comments. He's a media expert who gives us his time every so often.
Why now? Why has Facebook thrown Iran out of the ring now?
شبکه‌های بین‌المللی دنیا خب قاعدتاً از مخاطبینی که دارن بالاخره کسایی که
International satellite networks have audiences that need to pay fees to be able to use the contents of the channels. But you can see several Farsi-speaking channels out there that are working on huge budgets but won't demand payments from their audience. They produce a variety of programs for Iran and are looking for implementing U.S. policies on Iran and actively work to nullify what media outlets such as Press TV are doing.
The complete shutdown of the Facebook account of the Press TV network once again showed that the United States, despite its human rights gesture, does not give critics of America or Zionist occupation any rights in the media. But why do I say the United States? Well, stepping on the First Amendment's freedom of expression is a big feat for a social media company to undertake single-handedly. And looking at background, in November 2019, the U.S. State Department called on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to suspend the accounts of Iranian government leaders. That is but one instance of such crackdowns, which have not stopped at officials' social media accounts. Mr. Khoddadi is press deputy for Iran's Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance. He has given us his take on these matters via Skype.
The United States is perhaps one of the few countries in the world where the government completely dominates the media, despite the facade created by the private sector. If it wasn't the case, they couldn't have imposed sanctions against Iran, nor could they prevent other nations from cooperating with Tehran. The Americans completely dominate the rules and regulations made in these companies. Their security and political bodies have complete control over them. This is part of their very nature.
When something happens in Iran, like protests for different issues, the American media stir it up. But when that takes place in their country, when there are protests and dissent in the U.S., they impose restrictions in that region and won't allow people's voices to reach the world. We've seen instances where they even cut off the internet completely and don't allow the exchange of information to take place. If this happens in a country like Iran, they cover it with fanfare and impose sanctions against our government officials.
Why shut the Press TV platform permanently, and why now? I've been looking for all sorts of things we might have done wrong, and I can't find any. And Facebook refused to comment. It just said it was shutting down the pages of the station and some of its employees, and that it wouldn't say why, on security grounds. So perhaps Press TV has got it right.
We are not surprised that the hegemonic system removes any voice that isn't its own, and it has no other choice. If it accepts that this voice is heard, it would be creating a contradiction, because it has always painted a false picture of the events, and the public opinion would badger them for why they weren't showing the true pictures of things. Or if it silences the voice, it has gone back on the principle of liberal democracy. It has chosen to silence the voices, however, as it feels this option better benefits its interests.
It's self-evident. Facebook is no fair democratic media platform for opposing voices, following any clear, balanced community standards expecting social skills. So what might be the ulterior motive of what the Milwaukee Independent described as this creepy space that people can hide from their true identities to spread lies, rumors, nonsensical conspiracy theories and hatred unabated?
The United States and the hegemonic Western system do not adhere to any of the principle of a liberal democratic system. I will give you an example. The issue of elections is one of the main foundations of a liberal democratic system. But in 2006, people in Gaza went to the polls and elected Hamas. But they've been under siege by land, air, and sea for 15 years now because of the results of that election.
Truly, rather than serve as a social media company, Facebook has acted as a data mining company. How it helped decide the 2016 presidential election outcome was it let information on its users to the highest bidder, Cambridge Analytica in this case. That was the political data firm hired by Donald Trump's election campaign, which was given access to information on 50 million Facebook users, on their likes and dislikes and friend networks. Knowing of their likes and dislikes meant knowing how to target them with digital ads to affect their vote.
Communicating information and content production take precedence. Nowadays, there are so many different layers of communication due to the advancements in the field of information technology that where the information is being published doesn't determine its value. It's the content that does. If the information includes ideas that are comprehensible and needed, the message will be transferred in some way.
We are not living in a world where we talk about the word monopoly while referring to the dissemination of information.
The democratic world as we knew it has been cracking down on Press TV and Iranian broadcast pretty obviously since 2012. I'll mention some instances while reviewing what Press TV is and stands for. How the democratic world has so blatantly infringed this country's freedom of speech and voicing the voiceless is a matter to ponder on.
When there are no reports about Israeli atrocities and what transpires in countries like Yemen, there won't be any sensitivities. But if the information is reported accurately, people will question their governments. The U.S., which is usually behind such crimes, will have to be accountable. We are aware of the crimes the Israeli regime has been perpetrating over the years. The reports are being broadcast by the Islamic Republic's media. Naturally, the U.S., which is Israel's biggest supporter, won't accept this and works to prevent the information from reaching other people.
Facebook has been cracking down on Press TV and the likes, while alternative media's natural purpose is to counter misinformation by mainstream international media. But then, it is alternative, it is in the minority, and it's swimming against the current to sound voices stifled by world power state media. Media outlets around the globe have quite a bit on Western media censorship. So let's have a quick look before returning to our own narrative. So what are our select outlets for the day? Sputnik News, Evening Standard, and Newsweek. Russia, like Iran, is in the line of fire with US censorship. And its Sputnik News has put in quite a bit on Press TV's censorship by Facebook. Censorship and shutting down, actually. Facebook permanently bans Iran's Press TV over alleged policy violations. This is the second time Press TV has come under attack on Facebook this year. Last October, the Department of Justice seized 92 Iranian government domains, claiming they were being unlawfully used by Iran's Revolution Guard Corps to engage in a global disinformation campaign. Before that, Twitter removed over 100 Iran-linked accounts, supposedly trying to disrupt the conversation during the first Biden-Trump debate. In the summer of 2020, Facebook and Twitter labeled multiple Iranian, Chinese, and Russian news outlets as state media and blocked them from buying ads targeting US users. The state media labels did not apply to the BBC, Deutsche Welle, or other government-funded Western news agencies, nor to those accounts funded by the US government, such as Radio Free Europe. In 2019, Twitter deleted thousands of accounts it alleged were associated with the Iranian government before later admitting it never saw the CIA startup report which led to the ban. The same year, Facebook also deleted accounts belonging to prominent Iran's Revolution Guard Corps figures under the pretext of U.S. sanctions. On Facebook's double standards, the Evening Standard says, Facebook guidelines allow abuse targeted at public figures. Facebook's bullying and harassment policy allows public figures to be targeted online in ways that are otherwise banned on the site, The Guardian has reported. Internal moderator guidelines reportedly leaked to the newspaper says public figures are considered to be permissible targets of certain types of abuse, including calls for their death. According to The Guardian, the guidelines say public figures can be targeted in ways that the company bans for those classed as private individuals, although they cannot be tagged in the content, and its policy protects them from direct threats of severe physical harm. In response to The Guardian, a Facebook spokesperson said, "We think it's important to allow critical discussion of politicians and other people in the public eye. If you can't be sure a friend will stand by you when you next have a campaign, unfriend that friend," says Newsweek. It's time for campaigns to unfriend Facebook.
Everybody's social network includes that one friend, the one who shows up sometimes and completely disappears on you the next time. Eventually, you start making plans without them. For political campaigns, that unreliable friend is Facebook. Ironically, the company that redefined the term social network has shown a shocking lack of social skills when it comes to campaigns. Over the past months, Facebook has set increasingly arbitrary and bizarre bans on campaign advertising, making it virtually impossible for campaigns to use the platform. While harshly cracking down on legitimate campaign advertising, Facebook spent years doing next to nothing to stop damaging organic content like QAnon that spread like wildfire. Facebook's last 6 months of unpredictability is untenable for political campaigns whose staffers are tasked with planning how to most effectively spend budgets that can reach millions of dollars. The reality is, if Facebook is going to randomly restrict how campaigns are able to use its platform, planning becomes next to impossible. Campaigns are understandably beginning to tire of having their plans wrecked by Facebook's impulsive, seemingly PR-driven policy changes. That would be it for the news section. Back to our narration. Press TV has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship on multiple fronts. On Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, as well as on Google service platforms such as YouTube.
If you block Press TV, it doesn't mean you're turning it off. The world isn't doomed to know what the Americans want and not know what they don't. Those times are over, but they might be still dwelling in the past and pursue the same old methods. When Press TV is being targeted, it means it's been influential. No one would block something that isn't effective. The network has negated their interests. It promoted our people's interests. This could be the main reason why they target Press TV.
Press TV CEO Jebelli called for a parallel pressure campaign with Russia to counter Western dominion over world media. Irked by double standards and discriminatory policies exercised by Western media regulators, he said this was most evident in their behavior towards the IRIB's Press TV and the anti-Iran London-based Iran International channel. In September 2018, Iran International invited the spokesperson for a terrorist group to a live show in which he took responsibility for a terrorist attack that killed at least 25 people, including women and children in Iran, and injured 60 others. British media watchdog Ofcom failed to take any action against Iran International, whereas in 2012, Ofcom revoked Press TV's license and has threatened to do the same with RT, Russia Today. One's mind drifts towards the notion of legal complaint to some international media authority, the International Court of Justice perhaps, but it appears that would be as if complaining to the fox of its own tail. RT's managing director, Nikolov, said his correspondents were being targeted in a Western pressure campaign. Apart from their pages on social media being taken down, dozens of lawsuits were being filed against them at Western courts.
Today's world is not a time for massacres of voices. Today's world is not a time to hide the truth. The third decade of the 21st century is slowly forming a balance of power in the field of public diplomacy. It seems that this is the last desperate attempt that the ruling system is making to counter independent voices, that these voices will reach the international public in a variety of ways.
There are ways, if not with immediate effect. Press TV and RT have already taken steps to expand media cooperation. It was in 2018 that Nikolov and Jebelli signed a memorandum of understanding for cooperation in Tehran. That would be to take joint media and legal action against censorship crackdowns by the West. It is intriguing what more Iran might have done to free itself of dependence on American social media platforms and European satellites.
As you might remember, following the martyrdom of General Soleimani, who was a leader of the fight against terrorism, they placed restrictions on people who posted his photos or videos on several platforms, including Instagram. In many cases, there wasn't any violation of their policies and regulations. They did it unilaterally. I think we need countries whose policies are not in line with those of the US to join efforts and build a powerful social media network. We know that those who support the Islamic Republic, those who back freedom of expression and are opposed to America's policies, and even people from the US will join the network.
Press TV has been active, publishing its content round the clock, namely on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. But it also distributes its content on its own IPTV called YourMedium.com, given repeated censorship attacks by the U.S. tech giant Google's YouTube service. Many expected that with a Democratic administration taking the reins in America, Barack Obama's former vice president for that matter, media strictures would ease. But mainstream U.S. correspondents are complaining that with things getting worse at the Mexican border concerning immigrants, media access has in fact been compromised. Border police have in fact been muzzled not to address the media at all. And we saw how it took President Biden 2 months to hold his first press conference. That's the longest it's taken a president in 100 years. But for how long can information be locked up in this day and age? And should the truth out, how can the U.S. and West hold on to their power? Mr. Abedini explains.
Let's suppose they remove the voice of Iran from the satellite and social networks. But what can they do about the voices of people in China, Russia, Venezuela, Bolivia, Lebanon, Syria, and other nations? If they manage to silence all these voices, how can they silence the voice of those in the U.S. who say they can't breathe unless they kneel on the necks of each and every one of them, suffocating them? Otherwise, unless they can make these impossible steps, the voices will continue to be heard.
What's the power behind media regulators' decisions? Why this sensitivity towards Iran and its alternative voice? The entirety of social media is either owned or dominated by Zionists, as is the mainstream corporate media, as stressed by Dr. Kevin Barrett, American author and journalist.
Press TV provides information about Palestine and topics that run contrary to their interests in a professional fashion. People are aware. The free flow of information has raised people's awareness and educated people about media on an international scale. People tune into channels and websites that provide them with crucial information, those that they can't receive from American media. The U.S. government and imperialism are aware of how effective these outlets are.
Press TV was established in 2005 and launched in 2007 with the motto, News Anew, to present alternative news, stories underreported or even unreported. 14 years on since its launching, it is still, with all impediments, forcing out the voice of the voiceless to the disdain of Western powers and some mainstream world media outlets and the Zionist occupiers of Palestine. The 24-hour news channel does so via a website, newsroom and programs department, using satellite transponders and social platforms. So you see why it's important we remain unhindered by Facebook or otherwise.
Although social networks claim to be completely independent, in practice you see that they are acting in accordance with the general policies of the United States. That is, they implement policies that don't conform to even their own instructions and laws. When the U.S. government gives them orders, they easily follow them and disregard their own regulations to create restrictions for countries and governments. In this case, we also saw a similar pattern. I have been studying Facebook's terms and policies. There isn't a single article that Press TV hasn't adhered to. In fact, the channel's account has been complying with those exact terms.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team.
Do join us again next week and each week after, at least on The Box, as you never know what's on. Bye for now.
Still a high school student when the September 11 attacks happened, it became one of his most bitter memories in life and made him join the US Army after finishing school. He was known to be a man who would help anyone in need. From then on, Nicholas Slattern was a professional Army sniper serving with the 82nd Airborne Division. He was praised time and again and even received a Medal of Honor. Later on, Nick left the Army and was recruited by a private military company called Blackwater Worldwide Security. This company was founded in 1997 by Eric Prince, a graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former U.S. Navy SEAL officer. The U.S. Navy's sea, air, and land teams are commonly abbreviated as Navy SEALs. During the administration of George H.W. Bush, Prince secured a low-level internship in the White House. His small company and school in North Carolina offered U.S. Army and police with services and trainings in the field of special operations. Special operations are military, law enforcement, or intelligence operations that are special or unconventional and carried out by dedicated special forces. The September 11 terrorist incident brings huge changes for a small company like Blackwater. After the United States invaded Afghanistan and later Iraq, this corporation raised to the position of a major contractor of security projects, signing billion-dollar deals with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. The main responsibility of Blackwater was to protect American diplomats and politicians in Iraq. Slattern was deployed to Iraq with his friend in order to secure American diplomats after he joined Blackwater. His friends and acquaintances describe him as a man, a leader, and a great friend, and have run several huge campaigns in his support. None of them imagined that one day the media would call him a monster. Prosecutors said Blackwater guards have never shown remorse or accepted responsibility. And just a few days before the day in question, Nick had told his fellow men that he's going to kill as many Iraqis as he can to avenge September 11. September 16, 2007. The Raven 23 convoy was escorting a number of U.S. embassy diplomats through Nisour Square in downtown Baghdad. It was a calm and quiet day, but suddenly, the harsh sound of shooting filled the atmosphere. Nick Slattern, Evan Liberty, Dustin Hurd, and Paul Slough aimed their guns at a group of Iraqis and relentlessly opened fire on them.
قام يضرب عدة اطلاقات عشوائي رجع خوفا وضرب ضربوه من وراء
he was afraid and he was running then they hit him from the back
back وراسه مفتوح
and his head was open like this
open.
Blackwater guards succeed to control and overcome what appears to be a terrorist attack. The bodies of the terrorists are scattered on the ground and some still alive are heavily injured to the extent that they cannot move. Iraqi army officers are deployed to the scene to make a report of the dead and injured terrorists. The statistics that are announced later paint a new scene. 17 people killed and 20 injured, all civilians, mostly women and children. None of them had any firearms or weapons, or even an explosive. A 9-year-old Iraqi boy, Ali Kinani, is among those killed in the terrorist killing game of Nick and his friends.
A U.S. federal court judge handed down long-awaited day of reckoning for four Blackwater...
After years of litigation and an 11-week trial, a federal jury has found four former security guards...
It was one of the worst killings of innocent civilians.
The news of the massacre went viral. The hatred of American soldiers towards Iraqis had now been replaced by global condemnation and hatred towards Americans.
Why, I ask, why would they do this? We are civilians sitting in our cars. Most of the cars had families in them. So why did this happen? I kept hearing boom, boom, boom in my car. Bullets were flying everywhere. It was horrific, horrific.
The Iraqi government orders the expulsion of Blackwater and files a lawsuit on behalf of the families of the victims. The catastrophe is heartrending, and the pressure of the public opinion is high. The trial of Blackwater guards in court has a lesser cost than their trial by the public. So the U.S. government puts the proceedings on its agenda. The suspects keep repeating that they shot the civilians in self-defense, as they suspected that a car planted with a bomb is approaching them.
And I think there's been times when guys are using defensive force to protect themselves, to protect the package they're trying to get away from danger.
I wish they would ask the head of Blackwater, did he think that this child was a threat to his company? This giant company with all the biggest weapons, guns and planes. Was this boy a threat to them?
Blackwater Company offered Ali's father to quit his claim against the company in return for receiving a sum of money and seize all the legal prosecution he was following.
I said, I'm not taking a penny from you. I want nothing. I asked them if they wanted to resolve the problem. They said yes. I said, okay, get me a pen and paper. I said, look, I have a paper and I can sign and waive all my rights, all of them. I will sign now, but under one condition. I want the head of Blackwater to apologize publicly to me in America. And say, we killed your son, and we're sorry. That's all I want. I told them, I don't want $50,000 or $20,000. I just want him to publicly apologize. That would be enough for me. Blackwater's regional manager said, we do not apologize.
After years of investigation and hearings of 72 witnesses, the court finally judges that the convoy had been under no threat. Even Jeremy P. Ridgway, a former Blackwater guard, testifies against the other four and says that no Iraqi had aimed their gun at them. And when they opened fire on the people started to run away in horror to save their lives. Execution is the least punishment that the families of the Nisour massacre victims are seeking. But a federal district court jury convicted Nick Slatton of first-degree murder, giving him a life sentence, and the three other guards, Slough, Liberty, and Hurd, guilty of voluntary manslaughter, giving each 30 years in prison. Convictions that were all overturned later. 3 years after the massacre, on June 21st, 2010, Blackwater Worldwide wins another tender to serve as the main contractor to provide security services to the new U.S. consulate in Afghanistan. IRIB English Radio.